please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Cheryl from Circle of Hope, Philadelphia, right? Awesome. Have a welcome, Cheryl.
Hi, everybody. I'm Cheryl. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for having me here. I love this. This is my first time here. I love the fact that you guys say the set-aside prayer at the beginning of the meeting. That prayer really was a big part of saving my life. My sober date is November 20th, 2005. I first came to AA in 1996. So this is the longest period of sobriety that I ever had. But I was just talking to Kathy on the way here. I really only consider myself to be happy, joyous, and free for about the last 2.5 years, because that's when I finally did the work, took the action, and it's been amazing. So I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. I'm from Philadelphia. I was born and raised in Philadelphia. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. You know, all the 12-step stuff. You know, I have the privilege of sitting with other women and going through this. Through this process and seeing them light up, you know, I love AA. I just love AA. And my family, I'll just give you a little bit about my past. My dad he is an alcoholic. He'll tell you he's an alcoholic. He was actually a heroin addict, and he stopped using when I was 5 years old after his fifth OD. He got sober at Young Men's in Philadelphia. He slept on the floor. And, you know, after about, you know, he said about a year, he decided that AA wasn't for him. So he essentially, in our growing up, I thought I had a sober dad. You know, I went to Catholic school. My clothes were always pressed. We always had food, you know. I was very involved in activities and sports. And I danced for 10 years. And I was really good in school. And as a little kid, I can't understand why my home is so chaotic. On paper, it didn't look like it should be. And, you know, I know now that untreated alcoholism, you know, it's like in the book where he says, you know, you want to buy the person a drink, you know. And he was really suffering. And it was a very chaotic household. I don't blame that for my drinking. It does explain some things about who I became later on. But even as a little kid, I remember always feeling different. Like I was saying, I was very, like, I had a lot of friends and all this stuff, you know, like a cute kid. And you would have, everybody liked me. And I'm like the queen of TMI, too. Like, I'll tell you everything, you know. But as a little kid, you know, people said, you know, you could be a doctor, you could be a lawyer, what do you want to do? You know, you're really well academically and stuff like that. And in my head, all I ever wanted to do was, like, be a stripper, you know, or I wanted to be like, I did, like, as a little kid. And I'm like, I saw a TV show one time where they were talking about groupies. And I'm like, that's awesome. Like, that's what I'm going to do when I grow up. I'm going to be a groupie. And, yes, and that's before a drink, so. And so by the time I was 12 years old, that's when I had my first drink. You know, I was, like I said, did very well in school. I had taken the test for high school. I could have gone to the, you know, top Catholic high schools in Philadelphia area. I was accepted and picked up a drink, and everything was out the window. Dancing, I didn't go to dancing, I didn't go to karate anymore. I didn't hang out with my old friends. I got my first boyfriend, you know. I got my first punch in the face from a boyfriend, you know. All of this is like at 12 years old. And I started running away from home and, like I said, not going to school. And I had found a solution. I actually remember my first drink. And that's, I guess, how powerful it was for me. And I always think of that little girl, you know, like 12 years old, you know. I just thought I was so grown up. And I remember that relief, and I chased it immediately from 12 years old. And all I wanted to do was get back to that. You know, it didn't matter that my mom was crying and my dad was looking for me all over the place. I would find, like, I found a bunch of adults who drank all the time, and I could stay with them. And hide out and just try to stay in that space where I wasn't feeling so self-conscious and so wrong. Like, I always just felt wrong in my skin. So, and that didn't change. That didn't change until I took this action. You know, I was a 35-year-old, 12-year-old, essentially. I was still dealing with that stuff. And needless to say, I didn't go to those high schools. You know, by the time I was 13, I had my first suicide attempt. And that was around not being able to stop what I was doing. My parents, my dad found me. This was the first time, you know, that happened. My dad found me. I wasn't in school. He's like, get in this truck right now. I'll never trust you. I don't even know who you are. And I'm in that truck thinking, I don't know who I am. I don't know what is happening here. And he took me home, and I was watching the clock, and it was going really fast because I knew my mom was going to come home. And I was like, I got to get out of here. You know, alcoholism. I couldn't imagine getting out of it. So anyway, I didn't go to high school, those high schools. I ended up going to a business school where I could go to school in the morning and drink as much as I wanted. And then I had money to drink, and my parents just didn't want me to kill myself, so they just let me do whatever I wanted to do. And it was chaos, you know, and we all have our teenage stories, and it was bad. It was ugly. A lot of bad things happened to me. I was in a lot of bad situations, and I was really just trying to get by. And by the time I was 17, I had hit another wall, and it wasn't working. Like, I had tried every form of alcohol. I had been in a million relationships. I had jobs. I had lost jobs. I had done everything, and I felt like I hit a wall again. And I had a bright idea. I found the solution. You know, I thought up a great solution. I was going to have a child, you know, and that was going to save me. So, and in some ways it did. She did save my life. My family says that. She did save my life. But maybe that was God. Thinking that now, maybe that was an inspired thought from God, because she did save me. But 17 years old, I decided to have a child. And needless to say, she didn't. That didn't stop me from drinking. I married her father, and he was going in the Air Force, and everything was going to be great, and we were going to have a white picket fence, and it was in no time. Because I didn't know alcohol was my problem. I had no idea. You know, for me, I thought that was where I got my relief. Like, he was the problem. Like, anything that was going on, money was the problem, my parents were the problem, the world was the problem, you know, and I never saw that it was alcohol. So, you know, that baby came, that marriage fell apart, obviously, right? And the baby came, and, you know, as a parent, my alcoholism is, it's really smart and, like, slick. I always think that, like, it always, like, kind of knew how to get to me. Like, my mind knew how to get to me. And it would say, like, as long as you kept your daughter with you, like, you're okay. You know, it doesn't matter that you're dragging her through the mud. She has nowhere to live. You know, she's living off sugar wafers because you have no money. And, you know, she was like 2 years old. And you have her at the racetrack, and she's like covered in like soot, because that's where you want to be, and that's where what you want to do, that's where it's at. And I remember when she was 4, I got a motorcycle, and my dad said, you're not going to put her on the back of that, are you? Like, he believed that. That's how insane I was, that I was going to put a 4-year-old in the back of this motorcycle. And I look back, and I'm like, I understand why he thought that, you know, because that was probably a real possibility. It was pretty crazy. But so, you know, I hit my bottom really quickly, so my first bottom. And by the time I was 23, I was in my first treatment center. And the way I got there was my ex-husband took me there for psych. You know, that's why I ended up in there, and because I was going to kill myself. And I met a nurse there who was an AA. And I had heard about AA. Like, my dad talked about it sometimes, but he was insane, so I was never going to go to AA. Like, my dad, like I was saying, my dad, it's sad. Like, if you met him, it would break your heart, because that's untreated alcoholism. Because what he did was, he stopped using drugs and alcohol, and his whole life has been finding someone to blame. you know, look, finding ways to look outside of himself. And he, he's in his second round of interferon right now. But really, he's never, like, left his room in our house, like, in all of these years. I mean, I was five, so it's, like, 34 years without a drink. And he went to work, and he came home, and he just caused havoc in our house. And that was his life. And by the time I was 22, anyway, I'm 23. I was in my first treatment. And it was years later that I remembered that I had other people throughout my teenage years take me to AA meetings. Like, I had completely blocked it out. I went because they took me there. It was usually boyfriends or something, somebody who I was causing havoc in their lives. And I didn't remember until later to where, like, New Life, I don't know if anyone's familiar with New Life in Philadelphia. It's, like, in Kensington, and the Stepping Stones, who take me to the Stepping Stones, and I was like, oh, my God, these people are so weird. And nobody talked to me. Nobody touched me. Like, my head, like, and I was a mess. Like, I would be homeless. Like, you know, I would be just, like, at the bottom, and my head would tell me, like, something's wrong with these people. They're weird, you know. It's a cult. And but in that treatment center, I guess I was finally able, like, that was my first moment of grace. I was able to like, hear this woman. She was a nurse on the unit. She's like, did you ever think of stopping drinking? You know? And I was like, not really. And so she gave me some tickets to, like, a dance and in Abington. And I wasn't going to go to the dance. But it opened up something in my mind. It was like, well, maybe, you know. But when I got out of there, I started making meetings. I was in a different fellowship, and because I went to her AA meeting, and it looked really boring, so I went to a different fellowship that sounded like more fun. And so when I got there, I found out there were other solutions. You know, there was a lot of people there who liked to hug and hang out and go to parties, and, you know, there were boys there, you know, and it was like in my early 20s, and that was an awesome solution. I'm okay with that, you know. And so in no time, I was there, you know, and I'm not knowing. Now, at this point, I have no idea that there's a program here. I don't know why I didn't see it. I feel like I didn't see it for even 10 years after that, even though it was always there. I made a lot of meetings and never really sunk in that this was actually a program of action. I don't know. So, needless to say, you know, I was drinking again in no time. And, I had nevers. Like, I had a lot of nevers when I started, and by this time I had, like, two left, you know. And that was the only way I was getting by, you know, was by judging others. And that's how I could look at myself in the mirror, I guess. And at that, my brother is actually, he's a heroin addict. He's currently not using heroin, but he's on methadone, and he's using pills, and, you know, he's able to keep a roof over his head and stuff. You know, he's sick. He contracted HIV, you know, from his lifestyle, but when he was younger, the guy who introduced him to heroin when he was in a treatment center was, like, a friend of his. They ran together, and this guy always tried to talk to me, and I was like, oh my God, you're doing drugs. Like, and here I am, like, this is like 10 years of, like, just destroying lives and being completely insane. Mental institutions, I'd been in treatment. Completely crazy. But anytime he would try to talk to me, I would be like, oh, you're just so disgusting, you know, leave me alone. But this time when I came back, I ended up with him. He was my boyfriend. Like, that's how beaten up I was, though, at this point. Like, I had no more solutions. Like, I had nothing. Like, I knew no relationship, no job, my child. My untreated alcoholism comes to me as suicide. So even as a young girl, it always came to me, like, I just want out. I can't deal with this pain. No need to go into details, but those two last nevers came true. And, you know, before I knew it, I had left my daughter with her father. You know, at this point she was 5 years old, and I had left my daughter with her father, and I was running the streets. And I was finally homeless. I was I had cut off my parents completely. It was pretty bad. And the loneliness of that, it sounds like a funny story now, but at the time it really wasn't. Like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Penn Treaty Park. It's on the Delaware River. And this was a while, it's nice now, but a while back it wasn't that nice. This is about 15 years ago or so. But, you know, I woke up one day and there was like, I heard something around me, and there was like a dog over here and a little kid over here. And I looked up and there was like grass like hanging off my face, like looking at these people who were around me. Like, it was like the middle of the afternoon and people were in the park. And that was like normal. Like, I was like, oh, you know, they woke me up or whatever I was thinking. Like, get away, little girl, you know, your stupid dog, you know, and complete insanity. And so I tell that to tell you this part. So I ended up again in a treatment facility. But the only reason I ended up there was because the boyfriend ended up getting locked up, you know, because we had, you know, with Thelma and Louise. I mean, we're not Thelma and Louise. We're a Bonnie and Clyde, you know. We're boosting and we're stealing and we're so badass, you know. And so he got locked up anyway. And so I went to a treatment center. When I was in the other fellowship, I found halfway houses too, by the way, which was like cha-ching, like every I didn't know they were sick, it was sickness then, but everyone who was like me was like right there. In this like one neighborhood, there was like 10 halfway houses, you know. It was like, so it's funny when you think about that perception change now, but that's really what it looked like then. But so I called, you know, halfway house. It's like a young girl at the time, so you get people to do stuff for you. So I called, and I'm like, oh, I really want to get treatment. I didn't. He was locked up. I had nowhere to go. So these guys came and got me. They got me into a facility. And when I was there, there was a nurse on the unit. And this is my first real powerful God experience. She despised me because I was terrible. I was in there immediately trying to manipulate, take over stuff, you know. I had to be, like, cute, and I had to get my way, and she was, like, she wasn't having it. Her and I were, like, paddling, and so he got out of jail, and he found me because he loved me, right? I'm like, oh, he found out where I was. He's coming to get me, you know, and because we were so in love, and, you know, he got his mom, who was this poor woman who was just, like, we had just emotionally beaten the crap out of her his whole life, and him and his brother were both addicts, and he had her drive out to Fort Washington to get me, which is pretty far from Philly. And she came to pick me up. And they weren't going to let me out. And, of course, I, like, you know, I'm kicking and screaming and making a fuss and freaking out. And they finally let me out. And he picked me up. And that night, you know, he had, like, some money. And it was his birthday. And so we, like, got a hotel room at, like, the Roosevelt Inn on the Boulevard. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So we were, like, living large. And so crazy. But that night he was sleeping, and I got out of the bed, and I wasn't even sure why. And I was looking out the, I opened the curtains, and I was looking out the window. And at that moment, I knew it was nighttime, but there was like a light, and I just knew that in those years of grade, a Catholic school, maybe, I don't really know. But I knew that there was something that would save me, that there was something I wasn't seeing that could help me. I wasn't sure what it was. So I called those guys back at the halfway house, you know, and I normally wouldn't have done that. I would have given them time to cool down because I knew how to manipulate people. Like, I'm going to I'll let them cool down. I'll tap someone else for now, you know, and I'd burn them. But I called them, and they were like, you're never getting back in there. They're not going to let you back, but we'll call and see. And they took me back. They said, you know, you can come back. And I was on that same unit. And that was like a miracle. That was really a miracle. I was on welfare insurance at the time, so it was kind of like, you know, they had to go through a little bit of a hassle, but they got me back in. And when I walked back on that unit, that nurse said I looked like a different person, you know. And that's, and like, that was just God. Because I knew it. I knew there was something else. And, you know, when I got out of there, I had a different experience in there. When I got out of there, I made meetings. I made AA meetings, and you know, like I said, I was still young, so I met people who were like my age, and that's actually not really true. The first 2 years that I came out, I actually hung out with a lot of old timers because I was afraid. I was afraid of me. I had caused so much pain and havoc, and I was so afraid of alcohol that I didn't want to go back to that. So I kind of hid. I hung out. I got out of bed, and I went to this one morning meeting, and there was a bunch of old-timers who sat there, and I sat with them. And there were tons of, like, halfway houses there because we lived in the Kensington area. So there was a ton of people who were just getting sober there, and they were, like, my age, and I could have hung out with them. But I was really scared, and I didn't. And so I made meetings all day. And I just hung on. And, of course, I had a relationship at the time, so I wasn't, yeah, so there's always, that was always there. And, but I was able to get through 2 years like that. And, still a lot of chaos. I couldn't keep jobs. I was living with my parents. I had this, relationship that was crazy. But it was a lot better than when I was drinking. You know, I wasn't, I wasn't doing those things I was doing when I was drinking. At 2 years, I finally started talking to some people, and I started, like, going out and doing some AA things and hanging out with the younger people, and it was no time before I was acting up again, you know, character defects like crazy. It didn't even matter that those 2 years I had, like, hidden in AA and not, you know, barely moved. Like, that was, like, the only way I could control these character defects, and I wasn't even controlling them, barely, but, so a year later, no steps, still not hearing it, chairing big book meetings. I mean, not big book, beginners meetings. You know, we're going down this list of things to do. I'm like, I don't even know what these things are. The big book, I got no idea. You know, I'm reading it. I'm like, oh, that sounds interesting. That's nice. Now I'm looking at the steps on the wall. I'm like, yeah, you know, I did that. You know, yeah, I'm kind of a mess when I drink. I said I'm sorry to a couple people. You know, that was like, that's what I thought that it was. I just did it. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Like, how was I missing that every meeting? But, you know, so alcoholism told me I was doing okay. You know, I got a good job. I got a car. I got an apartment. I had some friends. And I had my daughter. She, you know, I had her in dancing school. And things are better when I'm not drinking. But I was hanging on to the fellowship and other things outside of myself. This relationship, shopping, you know, I ran up an insane amount of debt on credit cards. It was the first time I could ever, you know, do that. And a lot of outside things. And by 3 years, there's the wall again. And so I'm in a meeting, and I'm going to commit suicide. I'm going to commit suicide. God picked me up and literally took me to this meeting. I believe that. Like, I can see in retrospect, like, that poem, Footprints, I get it, man. Like, God, like, literally took me to this meeting. And all this great stuff was being talked about, and it was the Fishtown group, and I was, like, getting uplifted. And out of the corner of my eye, I see this guy come and sit down. And I swear to God, he had a light around him. It was like, oh, you know what I mean? I always say that, like, there's your next solution, you know, and forget all this other stuff that they're talking about. And, you know, he ended up being my husband eventually. He was actually sober 5 months. He had his backpack with all of his belongings on him at that meeting. And so I had an apartment. Why do you have to live in a halfway house? You can move into my apartment with me and my daughter. And we're going to be in love. We're perfect for one another. We had a couple late-night conversations that made me feel warm and fuzzy. So, of course, we're in love, you know. And in no time, chaos, no need to get into all the details. But so it was really bad. And instead of leaving, I married him. And, you know, about a year in. I guess I learned this from my dad, because I got 2 more years without a drink out of blaming him. And, you know, I I'd gotten to the place where I wasn't leaving the house. I'd always suffered with, like, what I thought was, like, depression, like, hardcore, too. I haven't had a depressive episode, I'll say, in the 2.5 years since going through this process. But I wasn't leaving the house, and it was him. It was all him. It was all his fault. And so he started drinking again. And, of course, he had to go to meetings. You need to get a sponsor. You need to go to therapy. You know, I'm, like, directing his life, and I'm, like, falling apart. I can't even see that I'm falling apart. And so he was using again. And when he came home, I said, if he's using, I'm done. I'm done. I was absolutely 100% convinced. And I'd never been that way about him and our relationship before. And as soon as he came in the door, I'm like, if he's drinking, I'm done. And he was drinking, and I said, give it to me. And it was suddenly. Like, that's the only way I can describe it. No matter what my convictions were, it didn't matter that I hadn't had a drink for 6 years at that point, almost 6 years at that point. None of it mattered. Didn't matter that 2 minutes before I was convinced because I was drinking, as soon as I had it in my hand. And no human power. Like, there was nothing between me and that drink. Like, I hadn't done any of the work. I was still that same girl, and I had run out of other outside solutions. And the scariest thing that ever happened to me in my life happened then. I lost any desire to be sober, yet I did not want to drink. That place, like, that in between, it was the most desperate feeling that I think I've ever had. I had this beautiful daughter. At this point, she's like 8, 9, 10 throughout this time. And I know she needs me, and my family loves me, and my niece always spends all this time with me, and I want to stay alive for them, but I just can't. I just can't. I don't know what to do now. And for 3 years, I went back and forth, I was drinking, and maybe I get a week, maybe I'd get a month. But I never wanted to come back here. I actually hid from you people. Like, I didn't come out of my house unless it was nighttime and I could hide out. Like, just completely, like you were looking for me or something. You know what I mean? Like, I was just completely insane and self-centered. Absolutely self-centered, because the world is about me. You know, if I'm drinking, you guys are out looking for me. The AA police is looking for me or something. And you're just waiting to judge me. You're waiting to see me to tell me I told you so, or, you know, how terrible I look or whatever. It's complete insanity. Like, the most love I've ever experienced has been in AA. And perception. But so I was done for. As far as I was concerned at that point, I was done for. You know, I was 30 years old. This has been going on for 18 years, hardcore at this point, and I was just done. I had a few really close near-death experiences. Like, I can't drink anymore. My respiration slows down almost immediately, and my lungs fill up, and I get pneumonia, and I'll die. And that happened a few times where I ended up in the hospital. I would end up in treatment, and just no desire to be sober. And finally, and this is where this sober story comes in, this experience comes in. I was in the hospital. No, before I went in the hospital, I was in my bed. And I was once again blue, laying in my bed. My husband's wondering how I'm getting so drunk. He's thinking I'm holding out. He's looking around, like, I'm like, I haven't left the bed in like a week. You know what I mean? Like, he's bringing it to me, and I'm like laying on the bed. I can't breathe. I'm like, I'm falling out, and he's thinking, you know, how are you getting so messed up or whatever? You know, because he's caught up in his own alcoholism. He couldn't even see that I was laying in that bed dying. And I had a thought that, okay, I'm going to die. I'm just going to lay here and wait to die. But out of my mouth, I said to him, I can't breathe. I'm going to jump out the window. And, that was most definitely God. And I guess it woke him up because he took me to the hospital. And that time I ended up in treatment. And that was November of 2005. And when I went into treatment, they told me, you know, make a meeting. As soon as you get out of here, make a meeting. And that's what I did. I went to a meeting, and there was a kid there, and he had 45 days. And even though I had at one point not had to drink for 6 years, it was amazing to me that he had 45 days. Like, I was like, I can't imagine. I don't know how I'm going to get through it, you know, one day at a time here. And so I just was making meetings. And when I came home from treatment that time, you know, the gas was turned off and things were pretty messed up. But I feel like it was the grace of God that, I know it was the grace of God, that energized me or gave me that push to make meetings and to kind of to get out there and take some action, because I really did feel pretty beaten down. And my soul was pretty dead. And like that spiritual malady had grown so big that it was, I felt like it was all I was. Like there was nothing else to me. And so I made meetings, and it was the first time like I had heard something, and I'd gone to this group that was near my house, and it was they had the Joe and Charlie tapes, and it was the first time I'd heard anyone talk about the Big Book in all that time. It was the first time I'd heard anyone like breaking it down and saying that it was a textbook and saying that it was a program of action and how all of my problems could be solved by taking this action. And so I got a sponsor, and you know, she did the best she could. She introduced me to the steps, and you know, we went through it. We went up to 9, and so I got, you know, I was getting the promises. I was feeling better. I was lit up, you know, because I had an experience, you know, and I was making my amends, and this is great. And I was jumping, and I, you know, of course, then I jumped to 12, you know, and for a little while that seemed, you know, it seemed like it was, it was the most amazing thing that had ever happened to me in my life. And so I started getting all these rewards in my life, all these material things, and I got a job. And that quickly, that job was like, oh, I can't really make a meeting. Oh, I'm kind of busy to sponsor people. You know, I'm not answering my phone. In no time, I didn't drink, but I had a 4-year period of time, almost 4 years, where I had slunk back into a suicidal depression. And I was in the, again, back at psychiatrists and diagnosed with all kinds of stuff and taking all kinds of medication and you know, antidepressant type medication. And, you know, I would have told you I had agoraphobia. Like, my alcoholism, like, when I was shown page 52, I was blown away. That was my entire life, those bedevilments on 52. So I was back in that again. I was in the grips of that again. And for 4 years, like I said, I was being treated for agoraphobia, which is a fear of, you know, being around people, leaving the house. Essentially, for me, I wasn't leaving the house at all. So in this crazy marriage, and it's going insane again, and here's God again, like, in a big way. Having this discussion with my husband, he never lied to me. He didn't. I made up this marriage, this, like, almost 12-year marriage was a story I made up in my head, by the way. He told me who he was from the very beginning, you know, and I made up a huge story around it, and I hung on to it. And, I think that's how I survived. To this day, something crept in. I saw something on Dr. Phil, and it was like, I asked him, I'm like, well, what about this? And he was like, yeah, exactly what you're thinking, that's right. And it was horrible to me, you know, it was just like everything came crashing down on me is what I felt like, because the story I'd hung on to, I saw that it wasn't true. For the very first time, I got on my knees. You know, I had prayed on my knees, but I was on my knees. I was on my knees in surrender, arms out, whatever you'll have me do. If you need to take away this relationship, fine. Whatever I have to do. And we'd been in this, I don't know if anyone's ever been in the crazy alcoholic codependent relationship, but like we didn't do anything without one another. And the next day, he was packing his stuff and walking out the door. And I'm watching him go back and forth, and I'm like, what the heck is going on? Like, I really do believe I was like, whatever. And God was like, okay, let's see if you mean this, you know? And he went, like, he had no reason, you know? It was really, I'm blown away by it. I don't apologize for God today. Like, anytime I've turned my will or asked God for help, it's always been incredible. So by him doing that, I ended up back in AA. I don't know that God carried me there too, because I didn't want to go. I'd barely left the house in 4 years. It was an inspired thought, because the last thing I was thinking was I wanted to go to AA. Like, I couldn't eat. I felt like I couldn't move. I was so depressed. I didn't know what was going on. But my body went to an AA meeting, and I raised my hand, and I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm insane, and my husband just moved out, and this chain of events happened, I think God believed me when I said I would do anything, and he carried me. Grace of God carried me. After that meeting, I made another meeting, and I talked to some women, and I had never had women friends, and these women sort of scooped me up, and they took me with them, and I ended up at a meeting one day that I was very, Kathy will tell you, I was very insecure, or I was ashamed. It's not insecure. I was so ashamed of myself that I would always, have a hat down here, always in black, covered up. I wouldn't really talk to anyone, and I went to this meeting, and I don't know if any of you have ever been there, but the Sunday morning Circle of Hope meeting, there's 50 people there. There's more than that, right? There's so many people there, right? And again, I'm my feet are moving, literally. God is literally carrying me, and I went to this meeting, and this chain of events happened. They never say their sober time. They went around and said their sober time. This guy stood out to me. He had the same month and the same year as me. Inspired thought, I went over to him. I said, can you direct me to someone to help me? He took me to someone, and it was the last person I would have asked, because she was adorable, and she looked like she just walked off of a magazine. So here's me. I'm just I don't want to be around any women, and she's just glowing, And again, God, the words, I guess, came out of my mouth, and will you help me? And she said, yeah, immediately, I called her, and she's like, well, when are we getting together? When are we going to start doing this? And we got to work. And I used to get a shower and, try to pick out my clothes, and I would go, find something to wear to go to her house. That's how bad I felt about myself. This woman was trying to help me, and I just felt like such crap. So that's why when there's a new person, I always try to go over there and because it's my experience, I try to go over and talk to them because I felt horrible. It really was God carrying me through. So we went through this. We went through the steps. We went through the actions. She explained to me that I had a spiritual malady, and alcohol was my solution, and it stopped working, and I needed to find another solution, and that solution was God. It was a higher power, At that time, I didn't have a great concept of God. Like I said, I had gone to Catholic school. I had never really learned anything else about God. But I did know that this crazy chain of events that just happened had to be something. And so I was willing. I didn't want to kill myself. I was really ready this time. Suicide notes were in, and I was convinced that my daughter and my family would be better off without me. And right before this whole thing happened, and again, she took me through the process, and she asked me, are you convinced that you're powerless over alcohol? Are you willing to take this action? There's action involved here, if you want to do this, let's get to it. And we went through the book. She was no joke. It was bang, bang, bang. We made times, and I was there, and we did this. And when I got to when we were talking about the second step, making the decision to turn my life over to God, I feel like I was so lucky there, because I was it was by default. There's nothing else. So okay, came to believe. I believed in when I went out, in Kensington to drink. I believed that I was going to come home. I believed that no one was going to kill me. All these crazy scenarios, So, okay, let me just believe that there's something that cares about me and is going to help me, and then making that decision. I don't know how long I would have held on to the decision, though, if I didn't move forward. We get right into action. And so I had made the decision, and I wrote out my my four step. And for, I know a lot of people are afraid to write out their four step, but I wasn't afraid to write out my four step. I wanted to get that stuff out. But I'll tell you, I was shocked when I did the fifth step. I didn't realize what it was going to be. I'm like, okay, I'm going to write down my resentments. I'm going to write down my fears. I'm going to write down my harms, and I'm going to dump this all on her, and I'm going to feel so much better after. It's going to be like confession. It's going to be amazing. You know, and it wasn't. And it wasn't that for me. That wasn't my experience. And I remember we were talking about it, and she was saying, you're judgmental. And I'm like, oh, like everything in me was just like, I didn't want to hear it. But like, you know, that was the one that stood out for me. But pointing out my character defects and my part. I didn't like it then, but when I went home and I took that hour, I found that, like, I couldn't sit still. There was something in me, like, when I was sitting there and I was like, wait, you know what? Maybe I need to sit with this for a second. You know, maybe I need to follow this direction. You know, my whole life I had been trying to figure everything out and finagling and just being that manipulator and, you just listen to direction, man. She told you to go home. She told you to read this to make sure that that this is complete. Like, go back over the steps and, you know, and see if up till this point, like, you feel like, you know, we're on track here. And so I did that. And in that hour for me, again, here's another one of those experiences, man, like, came over me, you know. I was able to hear it. So then I was able to move to 6 and 7 because then I could hear about those character defects. And I had a little bit more of a clear view of myself. I mean, trust me, I still had tons of work to do, but it was better than I'd ever had. Because as a kid, I had decided it was me against the world. And I was pretty slick. Like in second grade, I always think about that student of the month, and I had decided I was going to be student of the month, and I was student of the month. Like, I was like, okay, the teacher's there, make sure you're folding your hands. Okay, she's doing this, go ask her if she needs help or whatever. Like, in second grade, like, already manipulating around. And with this, I had to sort of, like, I had to just follow this direction and be willing to see that, like, maybe this thinking and this way of being wasn't right. And that would go back to, like, trusting God. And so then, you know, 6 and 7, I was able to do that. Like, I was able to ask God to remove my defects of character. And you know, he didn't, you know, obviously they weren't removed completely. But you know, I was willing to ask him to remove them. And in order to ask him that, like, I had to trust that he was going to protect me, because most of my character defects, when I look back on it, were from fear. They were always me wanting to protect myself, you know. They stemmed from, like, survival, most of my character defects. And so, you know, and then we moved on, and you know, from my fifth step, I already had my harms, so I had my list for my ninth step. And you know, I went out and I started making those amends, and I didn't have a ton because I had done that fourth and fifth step earlier in that sobriety. I had done some of my amends. I cleared up some financial amends pretty quickly then, but the ones that I had never realized. Like, at that time, I had in the beginning, I had said, like, I'm sorry to my parents, you know, I'm really sorry for what I did, and I didn't realize, like, I hadn't made a thorough amends to them. Like, I was still acting crazy. I didn't ask them. I didn't give them the opportunity to tell me what I had done to them and offer to repair that if there was some way. And, like, could they forgive me? So I was able to make those amends, and they were beautiful, you know. I saw my mom light up, you know. It's like she had been waiting her whole life for that, you know. My amends were pretty amazing, and some of my amends took a while after that. Like, you know, I still have some credit card debt that I'm paying, but the thing about that is that I pay it. You know, I called up my creditors and I made payment arrangements, and that had to be a priority. So, but those, you know, those going to people amends, I have pretty much cleared up. One just came to me recently that I have to do that I forgot about. Again, like, this was a $2,000 amends that I had forgotten about. I bought a motorcycle, and I was getting an income tax check, and there was a guy, of course, and he rode a bike, and he wanted me to get a bike, so he said he'll give me the money until my income tax check comes and I can pay him back. So I got the bike was stolen. So why am I going to pay him back? I don't have a bike, you know? And yeah, completely convinced that that was okay. Total insanity. So anyway, that came to me recently that I need to find him and pay him back for that. But I can laugh now because, wow, no wonder people thought I was crazy. No wonder people were dragging me to psychiatrists and trying to put me on medication, and my parents were locking me in the house, and so crazy, you know, 'cause they didn't want me to take my daughter and harm her. So now 10, 11, and 12, you know, 10 especially. For me, that was hard practice in the beginning. Like, I never liked to look at myself, and that practice, you know, picking up the phone and calling someone when I'm, resentful, you know, feared up, and talking about it. And one of the best things that, you know, my sponsor did for me was say, did you ask God to remove it first, you know, and then call me back, we'll talk about it, and showing me my part, and then turning my attention to someone else. Like, it seems simple to me now, but, like, I never knew any of that stuff. It just, none of this common sense stuff, I just never knew. Like, I don't know, do people learn that when they're children? I don't know. I never knew that you, like, apologize. Like, I couldn't apologize. I would find a reason why you did something that made me do that. Like, none of this made any sense to me at all. And so I had these people around me who were willing to help me. And in order for that to happen, though, I had to ask for help. And and like a spot check inventory, you know, as I'm going through the day, and I would call my sponsor and I would be like, this is going on and it's crazy. And, you know, and she'd just be like 86, 87, 88, you know, it's like right there, like upon awakening, you know, when we retire at night, as we go through our day and thinking about our day, it's all right there. And, you know, it took practice to implement that into my life. And it's funny because I would think, this is a pain. Like, this is so hard. Like, why do I have to do all this stuff every day? And now I think about, like, drinking ran my life. Like, it was a full-time job. And when I wasn't drinking, not drinking was a full-time job. And, you know, just constantly everything was work. But I didn't see that at the time, you know. Like, you can see that now. And 11-step, love talking about the 11-step. It's my favorite. And because... my relationship with my higher power is amazing. I don't know. I'm very interested in meditation and finding out and expanding on my spiritual practice and talking to people about it. It's my favorite thing to talk about. And I had no relationship with God. And so that's really a huge, like, it's fun for me to, like, go to, like, different churches. It's fun for me to read spiritual literature, you know. And like I said, from the little girl who wanted to, like, be tattooed head to toe and drive a Harley and be a stripper to, like, I like hanging out in, like, Buddhist temples now, you know, and having people over my house to meditate and hug trees and stuff. It's just crazy, you know. And I was really full of hate and rage, you know, and now I'm just like, let's love one another, man, you know, it's pretty amazing. But, and then, you know, and then 12, you know, after this experience, up till 11, I was able to go out and help carry this message to another alcoholic and practice these principles in all our affairs, you know. And it's like a design for living, like practice these principles in all my affairs. When I do that, my life is really smooth. You know, my life is really happy. And that spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. That was when, for me, like along the way, like I did, I got the 9-step promises. Like I did. And but really it was when I got to 11 that I really, like, you know, there's 11-step promises and everything sort of came in at once. And so during this time, you know, when all this was going on, you know, my husband had moved back in the beginning and stuff like that. I was financially dependent on him. It didn't matter. I still continued through the process. And in my life, I'll tell you what has happened since then. you know, I would immediately want to say, I called a friend, and this is what I'm talking about on 52, when she pointed that out to me. I never knew that that meant that's what I'm like when I'm not drinking. You know, this is me trying to stay sober on my own will. This is what it looks like. So I called her, and I'm like, you know, he's doing this and he's doing that. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. She said, you got your book there, open it up, you know, and she directed me to 52. And so I was able to kind of see what was going on. And, but I continued on and in that faith in God, I had no job. Like I said, I was practicing a lot of meditation and beyond my wildest dreams. This is what it means to me today. Like the life I have today, the job I have today, I never would have thought of. I knew I'm a massage therapist, and I never knew a massage therapist. I had had one massage in my whole life on vacation like 20 years before, and it wasn't even like the best experience. I was literally in my car, and it was not a voice. I'm not crazy, but it was like clear, like, go to massage therapy school. Like, that's God. You know, I went there. So, and then following that, you know, I followed that. I went and I looked for a school, and I went to the school, and it was exactly like beyond my wildest dreams, because I never would have dreamed that up. And in doing that, you know, I didn't want to be in that marriage, but it didn't matter because I'm not in control. You know, I'm every day I'm telling God, you know, I'm not telling God, I'm asking God to direct me, direct my thinking, you know, and help me to do your will and use me. And I let that go. I let that marriage, you know, be what it was. And I just went to school, and I continued doing my meetings, and I was kind to him, and I didn't want to be because I wanted to push, like I wanted to go. And that relationship fell off on its own. You know, I finished school. When I left that marriage, I had no money. I was still in school. I had nothing, and I had, you know, and that's that faith in God. I can't say I had faith in God, because it's not that. It's practice. It's a daily practice. And if I'm keeping that channel clear through these, you know, simple, my throat is scratchy. I'm distracted. But if I'm following these simple directions daily, that channel is pretty clear. And I feel like I can trust my higher power, and I'm going to be okay. And, you know, as soon as I made that decision that day, I got a job. You know, it doesn't always happen that way, but I share that because miracles happen, you know. And I've seen a lot of miracles. I see a lot of women who were never getting their children back, never, ever, ever, and they had their children back. You know, I have a lot of women in my life, so I use them as examples a lot. But two women that I know put their children up for adoption forever ago, and we're never going to see them again, and the children are back in their lives. You know, miracles happen here, and I've had a lot of them in my life. But, you know, I'm truly blessed. You know, my daughter, she's going to be 21 in June. She's, like, an amazing person. Like, God carried her through that. Like, my heart is so full of gratitude when I look back on my life. So I try to think of it as, like, now I'm here to be God's servant. You know, and that's good. That's great. It's like the best job ever. I was never going to be your servant. I wasn't going to listen to you. I didn't care what anybody had to say. It was, you know, I was dog eat dog, you know, and it's amazing. Like, I love everyone. Like, I love you guys. I want to be in service to my God. It's not every day is perfect, but that's where the freedom has come in for me. And I say I'm recovered because I don't think about drinking anymore. You know, I've been recovered from that hopeless state. You know, the obsession was removed, but even I'm recoiling as though from a flame, you know, like it's that the thought seems like it's insanity. So, I'm going to close with that. Thank you so much for having me. That's all.